This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the past few weeks, we've done several programs on the state budget crunch, the worst, many say, since World War II, but when the State House sneezes, an awful lot of city halls catch the flu. In New York City, for example, a $3.8 billion budget deficit forces Mayor Michael Bloomberg to prepare the population for fewer teachers and health clinics. Even the heroes of September the 11th face layoffs and hiring freezes. New York is a dramatic example of the tough choices faced by countless cities. Fewer cops or unrepaired roads, close the zoo or the swimming pools. For particularly hard-hit cities like Boston and Philadelphia, widespread layoffs of teachers, firemen, police, and other employees are now inevitable. And now smaller municipalities are beginning to make their choices about where to cut. At what point do shorter hours at the public library and longer lines at the DMV start to cut in to a city's quality of life? Is deferred maintenance a false savings? And how do you decide what to sacrifice and what to save? Later in the program, the College Board revises PSAT scores after admitting that one of its answers was wrong. You can take a look at the question in question on the Talk of the Nation page on our website, npr.org, or just get out your number two pencil. We'll read it for you later. Also, a review of the London production of Jerry Springer, the opera. But first, our series on tough choices looks at cities. What are the decisions to be made, and how are America's mayors making them? And we want to hear from you. What's happening where you live? Have cuts been made? Are they under discussion? How do you decide what's vital for your hometown and what you can live without? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll start today with a voice from the trenches. Joining us to talk about how a city decides what to sacrifice is the mayor of Minneapolis, R.T. Ryback. In the past few months, his city has laid off dozens of public employees and cut municipal works. Mayor Ryback, thanks very much for joining us on Talk of the Nation.
It's very good to be here.
When you got the news that the state was looking at cutting its financial contribution to the city, what were the first decisions you had to make?
Well, first off, even before the state got into its issues, I came into office with an inherited debt, and we'd already gotten a new city council and I together and said, we have to make choices, and our choices are going to be to do the basic core services, police, fire, and public works. So we already knew that, and we already had a five-year financial plan. But then when the state came up with a $4 billion deficit that asked us to cut 20% of our budget, it obviously had an impact.
Mm-hmm.
You said when the state sneezes, cities catch the flu. We didn't just catch the flu, we got SARS. And that meant we had to lay off 10% of our workforce.
Wow.
It meant that we had serious reductions everywhere. We tried to stay away from public safety, but even there we had to make some cuts and some layoffs.
Well, all right, you say public safety is the thing you try to stay hold on to the longest. What goes first?
Well, the first things that go are issues that you don't have to deal with immediately. I'd love to be able to say to the next generation that we looked out for their welfare as well as the previous one did. But we've had to defer maintenance to a significant level, and our infrastructure, I think, is one of those things that suffers most. It's not sexy. It's not going to wind up on the news that the roads were patched slower, the traffic lights took longer to get fixed. But those are the issues that really have to do with quality of life, and those are deeply sacrificed.
And isn't that a way of just passing this deficit really along to perhaps your successor? All this stuff has to get fixed sooner or later.
That's what we're very focused on now as we look at our next budget is we don't feel that we can do that because I don't feel it's responsible to do that. You know, we've heard a lot about books being written about the greatest generation, and I think we really have to make a choice because this is about states having problems and all that, but stop and think about what's going on here. We as a society have made a choice, and we've made a choice to spend more than $100 billion to destroy a country, and now we're going to spend how many billions more to rebuild it? And yet we haven't been able to make the choice to deal with our own cities. The entire state of Minnesota has been turned inside out over a $4 billion deficit. That was, half a day in Iraq. There are choices that are being made, and this is not just about the economy slowing. And I do think we have to get back to the core issues of where we live.
You mind if we take a call with one of your constituents?
Go ahead.
Jennifer joins us now on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to say first to Mayor Ryback, I think you're doing a great job in the face of huge budget deficits.
This must be your cousin, Jennifer.
But at the insistence of Governor Pawlenty and his promise not to raise taxes, that the whole state of Minnesota will be devastated, and the quality of life that we've all come to enjoy here. Instead of raising taxes, which I think a lot of people in Minnesota support, and maintaining the quality of life that we have, our quality of life is going to go right down the tubes, and Minneapolis is going to be one of the hardest hit cities in the state.
Well, I think what you're touching on, Jennifer, and thanks for calling, is this issue of quality of life, which is really mortar between the bricks. It's hard to quantify that, really, but what it's really meant in a city like Minneapolis, which is one of the most successful cities in the country, is that it's been long-term investment over a long period of time to do what we've been able to do so successfully. You reference this issue of taxes and how people do budgets. You know, we took a very balanced approach to this. We first cut deeply. Second, we reformed, so we merged different departments together and others. And third, we went out to our property taxpayers and said, we hate the property tax. We're going to have to ask for a little more. A balanced approach in a tough time. Our state has made a choice of saying that even in this tough time, even though in a period where there was a surplus, a rebate was given back to taxpayers, the governor is still not going back and doing that. I disagree with that. I believe citizens are going to say, first off, reform yourselves. Second off, cut spending. But third, we'll give a little bit more if we have to. We've made that choice in Minneapolis. I'd like our state to do that, too. And I'd like, as a nation, for us to get back to the issue of core basic services. Because remember, in addition to all of this, there have been huge additional costs shifted onto cities. All the homeland security issues have come here. Just in the war alone, we spent almost $500,000 in additional security. Those are additional costs, and the front lines in the new wars that we have are as often to be a firefighter or a police officer in Minneapolis as they are a person in the Army at some other part of the globe.
Jennifer, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mayor Ryback, when do you think the public is really going to start seeing these cuts, and where do you think?
Well, I think one of the things about what cities do is that the spending we do has the most direct impact on people. So they do see it. They do know that if there are fewer cops on the beat, if the street light isn't repaired as quickly, they do see what we do, and that's one of the great things about cities. So it does mean that the cutbacks that are being taken place, Minneapolis isn't unique, it's cities all across the country. People will see this now in time, but those deeper issues of infrastructure, long-term investments, strategic thinking are the ones you won't see. I think it's good to challenge government. I believe that there's too much government, and I think in Minneapolis we've done a very good job of merging and reinventing government. That's what we should do, and everybody has to do that in their personal life, and we should be no exception. The question really is how much is too much, and that quality of life question is one that I think we shouldn't lose track of.
Mayor Ryback, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
R.T. Ryback is the mayor of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and he was with us from his office in City Hall, and very happy to have him on the program. Joining us now is Christopher Haney, who's research manager at the National League of Cities. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
And what can you tell us? Obviously the mayor says, and we're doing the program because Minneapolis is not alone.
No, Minneapolis is definitely not alone. In fact, what the mayor described is largely a picture of what's going on in cities across the country. City revenues are not growing. City spending is increasing, driven largely by public safety and homeland security needs. And the state government certainly isn't going to be able to step in and help fill the gap. So cities face shortfalls themselves, shortfalls that in the year to come will probably get worse before they get better. And so they're faced with a number of choices to make. And the balanced approach the mayor described is one that most cities will likely use. They'll draw down their reserves. Cities did a very good job of putting money away for times like this during the growth of the 1990s.
Some cities did.
Some cities did. It's harder for larger cities in particular to do that, but the results were promising there. They are cutting capital spending. That's the unsung story here. The initial response largely across the nation has been to cut commitments to infrastructure investment and maintenance, and that's definitely about quality of life in the way that the mayor described. And then they're cutting services across the board. There's an emphasis there on not cutting in core areas, but there again, that has an impact on quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Our first caller, or next caller, is Roger, who joins us on the line from Manhattan in New York.
How you doing? Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Listen, I have two questions for your guest and yourself. What happened so fast, so quickly, that all the costs just spiked and all the revenues just dropped through the floor? My guess is it's probably health care for the workers. But I got to tell you, in New York, you can go through the bureaucracy of the city and just see half of the workforce doing nothing. I mean, they're in the court system. You see people reading the newspaper, and it's not so much because they're bad people. They're great workers. The way the rule system works in New York City government, there are just some things they're not allowed to do, so you have to wait until the next crew comes through to do it. I mean, it's sort of a mess.
Well, presumably productivity hasn't changed.
No, but in our world, in the real world, productivity's gone up. We can do much more with less, and I don't know why that hasn't carried over to government. I mean, I used to live in Minneapolis, and Mayor Ryback is a great guy. He's done a lot of good things over in Minneapolis. I just don't know why government is always last to catch up with that productivity curve.
Chris Haney, why have things gotten so bad so quickly?
Well, I think that what happens in any recession is that those two things happen. Spending spikes because needs go up. The communities that need city services don't go away in a recession. In fact, things get worse. So needs go up. For example, crime goes up, and so public safety spending goes up. That's exacerbated this year by Homeland Security needs. And at the same time, your revenues dip. And that's been the case in cities. Cities particularly that are dependent upon the income and sales tax, much like the states are, were particularly hard hit. So cities like New York definitely saw this. So you get hit by both things during the hardest times, and that's what makes things most difficult. As far as this perception of waste in government, I think that perception's always there. And as Neil said, it doesn't change whether the cities are doing well or they're doing poorly. I think it's largely based on the idea that sort of cities should operate much like the private sector. And they're two different models. So is there waste in government? Sure, there's some if you look at any time at any given point. For the most part, my sense is that city governments are doing a good job of trying to root out that waste and be more efficient right now, as Mayor Ryback said.
Roger?
Yeah.
Any further? Any other?
Only that it seems to me that... The gentleman's correct that most government seems to be always behind the curve in productivity. I wonder myself why it's so long, why it takes so long for government to shift into new things. Just real quick, one example. I walked into one government office and they still maintain this multiple form. I'm sure the guest knows what I'm talking about. Multiple form printer. It can print through 7 carbon copies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They use it twice a month instead of using, you know, like we do, computers that generate things over laser printers. And worse than that, this thing is maintained to the tune of $4,000 every month. Now that's just dead waste. The thing was built in the 80s. It probably cost a fortune to maintain because the parts aren't made, and they only use it twice a month.
I think that's a rhetorical question, Roger. We'll leave it there.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Well,
thanks very much.
Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. As you said, you know, how cities structure their income, that's had a big effect.
Yeah, I think tax structure determines a lot of how cities are dealing with the current crisis. Cities that are income tax dependent, and there aren't a lot of them, but they tend to be some of the larger, more notable cities like New York and San Francisco and Philadelphia, cities that have that reliance on the income tax, which took the hardest hit during this recession, really saw a dip in revenues that was very quick and very large and very hard to deal with. The sales tax, which is the second largest source of city revenue next to the property tax.
Just went up in New York.
Yes, has been more resilient than people expected. We've heard lots of stories about consumer spending propping up this economy. So the sales tax has done better than we thought, but still declined some in that sort of cities. For cities, it's the property tax that has been really the savior. So the cities that have been reliant on the property tax are the ones that have been most resilient.
We're talking about belt tightening in the nation's cities. What are you willing to give up to make ends meet? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after a break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how cities are stretching their dollars during these lean economic times and cutting what some regard as vital services. We want to know what's going on in your town. What's on the table? How would you choose what to save and what to give up? And how do you maintain the quality of life when the time comes to cut back? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Christopher Haney, Research Manager for the National League of Cities. Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Mark, who's with us from Warrenton, Missouri.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, or my point is, that in flush times, we watch our state and federal governments increase spending year after year, just like I do in flush times. But when things get tight for me, I naturally start cutting back. State and federal governments and local, then, they don't seem to want to cut back. We have a lot of these shows on where they're talking about what can we do to maintain the level of spending that we had acquired or attained in those good times. I'm not sure that we should. I think that we should be pulling back.
Chris Haney, doesn't local government have an obligation to tighten its belt during tough times?
Yes, I think it does, and I think for the most part, every effort is being made to do some of that. We conduct a survey each year of city fiscal conditions, and this year we're predicting that it will show cutbacks in city spending levels. So I think nationally you'll see an effort to do that. The difficulty there is that if you thought about it in terms of your rent, if your rent goes up, you can't reduce your spending next year. Much the same is true for cities. If health care costs go up, if the cost of employee pensions go up, you're going to have a hard time cutting your spending. So a lot of it has to do with rising costs that cities largely don't have control over.
One thing we've seen, for example, in the airline industry, they're facing bankruptcy, some of the big airlines, and are renegotiating their contracts with their unions. Are cities facing the same kinds of decisions about public employee with public employee unions?
Yes, I think they are. They're facing that at two different levels, one of which is that a lot of cities are facing layoffs, so they're having to deal with negotiations and the political ramifications of laying off city staff that are unionized. And then also, as part of that, looking at the costs of their relationships with employee pension plans and such, they're having to renegotiate some of those benefit packages and see if they can cut costs in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
When it comes to budget cuts, decisions about what will get the axe, that's usually kept within City Hall, with public input restricted to budget hearings and letters to the editor. One city currently facing down the barrel of an empty bank account is taking a different approach. Joining us now from Portland, Maine, is City Councilwoman Jill Dusan. Thanks very much for joining us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
Portland, Maine has decided to involve the public in the budget drafting process in a rather direct way. Would you tell us about what's going on?
Yes, our traditional process would have us work for months on the budget and then have a public hearing at the end of the process asking citizens to come in and give us feedback. What we did differently this year was develop a public questionnaire, send it out to residents of the city in our local newspaper, and create a opportunity to respond to the questionnaire on the net at portlandbudget.com. Our goal was to get more input because this is a third of several consecutive bad years. We are looking at some really tough cuts proposed in police and fire safety and those kinds of basic services, and we wanted to go to the citizens and get some direct feedback from them before we made those decisions.
When you got those responses back, what did you learn?
Well, we got back over 2,600 responses. This is in a city where we're accustomed to having maybe 25 people show up at the hearing at the end of the process. We on the survey, there were some yes or no questions plus three open-ended questions. We put together over 400 pages of text of comments drawn directly from the open-ended questions. And people were all over the place, as you would expect.
Sure.
A retired homeowner who says, I'll be forced to sell my home if you raise taxes, to property owners who say, I'll pay anything to keep city services functioning.
People with kids say, don't cut education. Maybe people without say, you could scrimp a little there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Is the budget you ended up with different because of this process, do you think?
Very much so. I think that we got the strong message that folks would support a slight increase in order to preserve basic services like public safety, fire, and police. And those items are back in our budget. There are a number of other items that are still gone, that are around administrative items. Folks responded that there were parts of the education budget that they were willing to live without. We really put it all in the mix. The other thing we did in addition to the questionnaire was tally all the results, take that 400 pages of text, put that out to the public in our local library branches and at City Hall, and then we had two community conversations on the budget where we had nearly 500 people show up and listen to our report of what they had to say to us and have some discussion about how we should balance the issues.
The involvement of the public, I mean, it sounds terrific. I mean, some people might say, you know, hey, a little bit more, not exactly direct democracy, but more public input can't hurt. On the other hand, politicians might say that, you know, this is an opportunity to you'll excuse the expression, cover your rear ends a little bit. That, you know, the cuts are going to have to be made. Maybe we can spread the blame around a little bit.
Well, we sure got those kind of comments. I mean, several people accused me as Finance Committee Chair of using scare tactics so that I could then raise the budget, raise the property taxes any amount I want in order, because I've scared people into thinking that no one's going to respond when there's a fire at their house and that kind of thing. So I think we needed to do some work to build some credibility in the process. Those community conversations that followed the survey were about coming back to people and saying, yes, we're going to be responsible about the input. Here's what you said to us. You can hold our feet to the fire and watch the process. We presented our budget to the full council last night, and I hope that people can see their issues and concerns and input in the final package.
Thanks very much for joining us, and I hope your cold gets better.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Jill Dusen chairs the Finance Committee for the Portland City Council, and she was with us from her office in Portland, Maine. And Chris Haney, I wonder what you think of Portland's experiment.
It's a great idea. What Jill said about building credibility, I think, is the key there. That city officials have some tough choices to make in the future and right now is certainly true. To the extent that they can raise public awareness about the difficulties of those choices, about making priorities among certain services that the city's view as a priority, will be a big help. And it builds credibility and it makes the blow a little easier to take.
Are other cities doing this kind of thing?
I think that there are cities doing a lot of this kind of thing. The trick is really to get away from the sort of traditional models of civic engagement. The public hearing, the town hall meeting, those work to some extent, but a lot of times city officials say what they get are the same sort of people showing up about the same program each week. So I think it's about taking this through new mechanisms out to the people and building a support network.
Let's go now to Tom, who joins us on the line from St. Louis.
Hi. Yeah, my name is Todd. I actually live in Kansas City, Missouri, and our city is doing something really strange at a time when they're scrounging around to find money any way they can. They're giving their city employees the medical benefits with their spouses.
Todd, I think we're having trouble with your cell phone. Give it one more chance.
Okay, the city employees are covered by medical insurance, and so would their spouse covered also.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the city's trying to make it to where they can cover the unmarried couples, as long as, especially for gay people, they're the ones who's really pushing this, is that they want to give benefits to the homosexuals who are unmarried. And a lot of people are thinking, is this the time for that? You know,
to their partners. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, any kind of partner, anybody really, I guess. Oh. As long as you say they're my partner, they're covered under medical insurance.
Well, Chris,
especially for gay people, I think is what it's boils down to.
Well, Chris Haney, as Todd suggests, there are some reforms like what he's talking about, the extension of health benefits that are extended to city employees, spouses, to partners of homosexuals who are employed by the city. And these are regulations that were passed, and now they're are these catching up with cities?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the issue that the caller raises is really less about sort of a choice that a city can make between providing one service or spending in one particular area, and more about court decisions and regulations that have been handed down and complying with those, or facing severe restrictions because you don't.
And a lot of city councils have passed ordinances saying you have to now do this because it's fair.
That's right.
Okay. Here's an email question from Michaela, if I'm pronouncing that rightly, in Phoenix, Arizona. Arizona is cutting back by putting many governmental services on the Internet. The Department of Motor Vehicles is just one example. Personally, I think this is great in the long run. However, people are losing jobs. My question is, how much money can be saved by moving services to the web?
There's probably some money that can be saved there. The issue really is access. In this case. So it's about who has access via a computer to the Internet in order to be able to use that service. So if you've got a city hall and anybody can walk into that city hall and sidle up and pay their license fee, it's not so much of an access issue as it is as if you have the means to afford a computer, to have access to a computer, you then have access to the web. So it's something that as access becomes much more prevalent, will be something that will save some money. Right now, I think it's still limited in some regard.
A lot of the same issues involved in web voting and that sort of thing.
Correct.
Yeah. Let's go now to Samantha, who joins us from Arlington, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am a mother of a young child, and as such, I use a lot of public services in Arlington. I use a public library, which is also a recreation center, a lot, and they are threatening to close this library. And from my perspective, I'd be spending a lot less money on higher taxes than I will be when I have to pay for private services, as in a place to bring my child. And I think that that's my example is just one of many where the services that we'll be losing that we'll have to pay for. And this costs us a lot more than if we all chipped in and paid a little bit more so we could retain those services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks very much. Chris?
Samantha, first I would encourage you to contact one of your selectmen there in Arlington, Massachusetts, Charlie Lyons, who will be the National League of Cities president incoming in January. On the issue that you raise...
Oh, he's going to wish you didn't know his
name. I know. Charlie's going to owe me on that one. On the issue that you raise, it's very important, actually. One of the ways that cities are balancing their budgets during times like these is that they're raising user fees and charges for services. This is something that's been going on for the last 2 to 3 decades, movement away from taxes and towards fees. The issue there, again, as with the web example, is access and who has the ability to pay. And if you're basing your provision of services on the ability to pay, that makes the provision of social services quite difficult and much more difficult for the neediest communities.
Mm-hmm. Samantha, would you be willing to pay more?
Well, I'm going to have to, I guess. I mean, in terms of taxes, absolutely, I'd be willing to pay more in terms of taxes. If they close a library, I'm going to have to pay for a place to bring my child. I don't have a choice.
Okay. Well, good luck to you. I appreciate your call.
Thank you.
We're discussing the problems that many cities are facing and more will be facing when the next fiscal year starts as a result of big budget crunches all over the place, not just in the cities, but in the states that often assist them with their budgets. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Brian, who's with us from Salt Lake City.
Hi.
Hi.
I own a company that provides software to kind of a subset of the public world. We provide software to utility companies and like water districts, electricity, gas, and so forth. And I've noticed a trend. We've really seen no change in the number of individuals who are purchasing this software or buying maintenance and so forth. And I speculate that that's because people have to have water and they have to have gas. And so the revenue is somewhat insulated, even within the public arena, from an economic downturn. And in fact, I've noticed that other agencies are forced to compensate for this because if a group of individuals, say, come unemployed, they can appeal for assistance, and then that assistance turns around and funds these utility companies, which are subsets. And so I guess my question is there any effort that Chris is aware of to stabilize this within government so that one leg of government isn't bearing all the burden and it's being shared equally?
In most places, these are public utilities, but go ahead.
Yeah, they are public utilities.
I'm not sure what the answer is in terms of stabilizing this across levels of government. The sort of first answer is that there's some insulation for local governments on utilities and sewer and water types of activities because they've largely gone to fee-for-service-based models here. So the revenue that comes in is based on fees that you pay as a user, which is based on how much you use. So it's not subject to the sort of ups and downs of the business cycle the way taxes are. But you raise the larger issue of sharing the burden across levels of government, and that's really where there's a real disconnect within the intergovernmental system in the United States right now. We've really gone away from a partnership among cities, counties, states, and federal governments to deliver services for their citizens and into a sort of a pointing fingers blame game about whose responsibility it is and why isn't this being paid for. And to the extent that can be overcome, we'd really be doing a service to the American people.
Brian, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's see if we get one more call in. Mark joins us on the line, and Mark is in Louisville.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just kind of a story slash point here. Here in Louisville, in our Jefferson County area of Kentucky, we have, you know, over 40 different little cities, and this came about from an archaic law limiting the number of distilleries that one could have in an actual city limit. So you have this county, which is now turned into a very metropolitan area with all these little tiny cities, and we had a city government of Louisville and a county government that recently merged. So we merged everything into one big Louisville metro government.
And how did that affect the number of distilleries? I'm just joking. Go ahead.
Well, it's good. Distilleries are the same, which is good for us. But what is interesting is, you know, you have all these little tiny, teeny tiny municipalities that have their own fire service, their own mayor, their own mayor's office. Mayor's cronies that are getting paid from the mayor's office. And with that consolidation, it seems that things could, you know, things are going to get better. We had a county
economies of scale, if you will.
Yeah. We we're still doing the changeover, which is, you know, it's getting there. It's going to be nice. But we had county police and we had city police, two totally different departments, two totally different pay scales, two different unions. The county police were running different radios than
Mark,
no one could talk to each other.
Mark, we're running out of time, and I'm going to encapsulize your question. Are some of the reforms that are going to be imposed now because of cuts, aren't these, you know, might they turn out to be beneficial, like the ones Mark talked about?
Well, certainly tough times bring about sort of incentives for efficiencies, and I think you will see those efficiencies emerge in interlocal agreements. So agreements by municipalities to share service provision and cut some costs that way.
Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our guest here in Studio 3A this afternoon, Christopher Haney, Research Manager for the National League of Cities. Thanks very much for being with us. When we come back, keep your number two pencils handy. 500,000 high school students will get new scores on the PSATs after one question left a teacher questioning. You can try your hand at the seditious sentence at our website, www.npr.org. Stay tuned for the answer. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.